It is the BBC third programme. We present Emily Butter, An Occasion Recalled, by Henry Reed. The occasion referred to is, of course, the first performance of Hilda Tablet's opera, Emily Butter, at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. Several recorded excerpts from this work will be heard in the course of the programme. The occasion is recalled by the composeress's friend and biographer, Herbert Reeve. Mr. Reeve.
We are greatly honoured by the invitation that has been extended to us this evening. The interruptions that a scholar's work may undergo have a charm that is all their own. This is especially true when he is able to impose those interruptions on himself. Ever since we came out of the nursing home, we have found ourselves yielding very frequently to the temptation to lay aside our pen and to allow Fortune's finger to play what stop she pleases upon the pipe of our memory. That is an image derived from the lovely art of music. And how apt it is in this case. For whenever we are resting, and we still have to rest rather a good deal, it is Hilda Tablet's great opera, Emily Butter, that insistently comes to our mind. It has been well said that on that memorable first night at Covent Garden, this opera swam into our plan like a new Kennet. Swam into our planet like a new Ken, we should have said. It had, of course, swum into into those of several other European countries already. But that fine October night saw Great Britain's first clear view of it. Our own part on that splendid occasion was but a small one. Though no one could have been more loyally, to use another musical image, more loyally keyed up than ourselves. We had, of course, been present at most of the rehearsals. It had been a new and moving experience for us to see Hilda herself conducting the orchestra. We had admired, to the point of envy, her calm, easy, silent efficiency.
Lovely. Now, come on up. Keep that. Guts, guts. Now, boys, ride it. Ride it. Ride it. Ride it. Good.
We had also admired the lucid and coherent description of her own musical aims, which Hilda had given in one of the 9 preliminary talks and discussions on the opera put out on the former third programme in the fortnight before the work was performed.
I know that a lot of people will be asking why so much of the music in my opera, Emily Butter, is so frankly diatonic in character. Frankly is, of course, the operative word. I mean that I am in no way ashamed of it. Still, it surprised a few people, and perhaps I'd better explain. The entire cast of my opera is female. The action takes place in a large store. And the store is, of course, completely manned, completely staffed, that is, by women. Now, this has given me a splendid opportunity, and one I've always wanted, of enshrining in a single work the whole of English womanhood. Now, let's look into that. I think it may justly be said that English women in general are very common diatonic little numbers. They differ very greatly in this from the women of North Africa, for example. The heroine of my opera, Emily Butter herself, the little shop assistant, is a girl who has lived a life cut off from reality, just like the characters in Il Trovatore, for example. It's natural, therefore, that her music should be, for the most part, straight tonic and dominant marmalade, so to speak. Normal music, I've heard it called. And the same goes for most of the rest of the cast.
Various distinguished musical critics have taken up this theme for the benefit of listeners. We recall particularly an illustrated exposition of the character of the music broadcast 2 days before the opera itself. We have forgotten who this talk was by, but we fancy it may have been the music critic of Notes and Queries, Mr. Gabriel Hall Pollock.
Good evening. Into a world...
Yes, it was Mr. Hall Pollock.
into a world that has been for so long starved of colour and beauty, Miss Tablet's opera, Emily Butter, floats with all the glorious certainty of a golden age recovered. We all think at once, of course, of Guarini's chorus, O Belle Età Delorum. And what I think will strike listeners who know Miss Tablet simply as an autonomist will be the delicate exploitation of normal major-minor ambiguities she achieves in this work, together with its contemptuously brilliant flow of melody. She has that gift which only the greatest have of suddenly producing out of eternity a melody, almost, to put it vulgarly, a tune, which seems to have been existing there forever, just waiting for Miss Tablet to entice it out. With the aid of Miss Elsa Strauss, who is singing the part of Emily herself next week, I am going to try to illustrate this on the piano. Now take, for example, the passage in Act 7 where Emily gets herself locked into the lift. Here we have a series of fragmentary utterances, pathetic, wistful, and disjointed, which suddenly melt into a heavenly curve of melody. This is the recitative.
I do not know. Something seemed to snap inside of me. So late to go. It is far, but I have
And then suddenly and exquisitely, she sings the perfectly glorious melody, utterly original, but which we have yet almost seemed to have known all our lives.
It is so late and I have far to go. It is so late and I have
Thus prepared, the whole of musical England must have felt the excitement of the last few minutes before the curtain went up in the beloved old opera house. We shall not easily forget the splendid scenes in the foyer, so keenly delineated by the ever-admirable BBC commentators.
I do wish you could be here with us this evening and see the brilliant assembly in the beloved old opera house. From where I am standing, I can see scores of distinguished visitors, the men, of course, in full evening dress with orders, mounting the beautiful great staircase to the upper foyer, while others, equally distinguished, are descending it on their way to the lower foyer. From where I am standing, I can see the ambassadors from the United States and the Soviet Union smiling and chatting with Sir Egbert Cunliffe, the High Commissioner for the Arts Council for Great Britain, and just being approached by... Oh, no, no, he's just gone away again. Poets, painters, actors, dress designers and musicians are to be seen on every hand. Ah, now everyone has turned to the doors leading from the street. I think... No. Yes. The composeress's great friends, the Duke and Duchess of Mulsitt, have just arrived. The Duchess herself is looking very lovely, in a crinoline gown of madreperla with ruched flutings and a wide single band of silver lamé reaching over one épaule, and, as far as I can see from the front, ending in a huge silver catastrophe at the back. She is leading by the hand her five-year-old son, the Marquis of Mulchester, who is eyeing with lively interest the great gathering of grown-ups around him. He is carrying a souvenir program almost as large as himself. And now the Duke and Duchess of Mulsitt are making their way towards their box.
We ourselves were privileged to join the Duke and Duchess of Mulsitt in their box that evening. They had, of course, been concerned with Hilda's opera from its earliest inception.
How are you feeling, Reeve? Bobbish?
Huh? Oh, very, very. Are you?
Oh, very.
Jack is so phlegmatic. I'm all on edge. I always am on these occasions.
Very natural, of course.
Still, I know that the moment the orchestra begins, I shall be at peace.
Daddy!
And after all, there's never anything quite like the first night in Covent Garden, is there? It's like
Like Byron, isn't it?
Byron?
Daddy?
The Night Before Waterloo in Childe Harold.
Yes, of course.
With dear Hilda as Napoleon. Wellington, I mean. There was a sound of revelry by night, and Belgium's capital had gathered then her beauty and her chivalry.
And bright the lamps shone o'er bare women and brave men.
Fair women, dear.
What did I say, dear?
Something else, dear.
Daddy!
Yes, old boy? Don't keep tugging. What is it?
Daddy!
Yes?
Daddy, when are we going to see Uncle Hilda?
Yes, indeed. Great Britain's capital had unquestionably gathered there her beauty and her chivalry. The admirable radio commentator in the next box had just made much the same point. Only, of course, in his own words.
I do wish you could all be here this evening with me and see the glittering sight in the beloved old opera house. Everywhere I look, I can see the great and the distinguished from all walks of life. There's sport, religion, politics, the arts, science, all are represented. At the end of the third row of the stalls, the Lord Chief Justice is studying his program there intently. It may be mentioned that the opera itself touches on the subject of delinquency. The musical world is supremely well represented, of course. In the sixth row of the stalls, from left to right, I can see Sir John Barbarolle, Sir Thomas Beecham, Sir Arthur Bliss, Sir Adrian Bolt, Sir George Dyson, Sir Malcolm Sargent, Sir William Walton, and Sir... I can't quite see... Oh, yes, Sir Stuart Wilson. All sitting in alphabetical order, very relaxed and happy. Literature also is here. In the box just opposite, I can see Mr. Graham Greene, Mr. T.S. Eliot, Mr. Angus Wilson, and Mr. J.B. Priestley. Also, very relaxed and happy, a merry party. And now the lights are going slowly down in the auditorium, and everyone's settling expectantly into his or her seat, as the case may be, and we're all waiting for Miss Tablet herself to appear. Yes, a bright light has just been shone on the opening of the curtain, and someone has just appeared before the footlights. I think he's about to make an announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have an announcement to make. Owing to sudden indisposition, Miss Gwyneth Morgan Davis will not be able to sing the part of Helen Sparge this evening. However, at literally a few hours' notice, Signora Luciana degli Scogli has flown from Milan to take over the part. Signora degli Scogli will sing in Italian. Thank you.
Well, I expect the listeners will have heard that announcement. And now everyone is again waiting expectantly for Miss Tablet to appear.
We were among those expectant souls. They were anxious moments, of course, but not unmixed with delight. We should have said they were delightful moments, but not unmixed with anxiety. Here's.
And now Miss Tablet has at last appeared with her baton and is bowing to the orchestra.
Miss Tablet is wearing a simple black two-piece costume, and from the back one can see that the upper half has beautifully cut swallow tails, reaching about 9 inches below the rather short black skirt. And now Miss Tablet has turned to bow to the audience, and one can see that the upper part of her dress opens to reveal a dazzling white shirt front, surmounted by a knotted bow of some stiff white material. As Miss Tablet a moment ago bowed to the audience, a large white carnation fell out of her buttonhole, over the orchestra rails and onto the floor. With a graceful movement, Miss Tablet has just bent over the rail and swept it up in her left hand.
With a charming gesture, Miss Tablet has kissed the white flower and waved it in the direction of the little Marquis of Mulchester, who's now standing upright in his box with the Duke and Duchess of Malsey. Gestures evidently a popular one. The little Marquis of Malchester has accidentally dropped his programme over the edge of the box. It's dropped onto the head of... I can't quite see. It's fallen onto the head of Sir Edmund Hillary. And now an amusing little diversion has occurred. Sir Edmund Hillary, fresh from his great triumphs all over the world, has quickly and agilely climbed up the side of the box and handed the program back to the young Margaret. There's much affectionate laughter round about. Now the audience is once more settled down. Everyone's looking very relaxed and happy. Miss Tablet has opened the first volume of the score in front of her.
This, then, was the moment we had so long been waiting for. There at last below us stood Hilda Tablet, our friend, silhouetted against the softly glowing lights of the great, splendid, loyal orchestra. The long anticipation was at an end. As Hilda slowly raised her stick, her baton, those of us who enjoyed the privilege of her friendship all felt what the Duchess of Mulsett had so very sensitively expressed a few seconds earlier.
Peter, if you push your programme over there again, I shall smack your bottom.
We all felt what the Duchess of Mulsett had so sensitively expressed a few minutes earlier.
I know that the moment the orchestra begins, I shall be at peace.
The curtain has risen and revealed the beautiful set representing two floors of the large department store of Messrs. Body and Body. Behind the great windows at the back, one of Mr. John Piper's magnificent sunsets can be seen. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and a large army of cleaners is to be seen on their knees, working away vigorously.
Scrubbing, scrubbing, scrubbing! I scrub and I scrub, I scrub and I scrub!
I work my fingers through the bone, fingers under my nails!
Polishing, polishing,
the long, long horror of the same great law.
Clean is clean,
and half an hour later, as bad as it was before.
Vile great tyranny of the scrubbing brush, and no rise in pay for the last fortnight. We ought to stick together for the unions, that's what I say. We ought to have a closed shop. I wish all shops were closed.
How it went to the heart, right from the start. Those of us who were privileged to hear the words must have felt it even more so. It is well that an artist should show his feelings, his ethos, at the very opening of whatever he write. Miss Tablet's ethos, as we all knew, was writ large on every page of Butter. Her anger at the thought of tyranny, she was herself incapable of tyrannical word or gesture, her keen sympathy for the underdog, We have personally observed her demonstrations of this. Her devotion to the underprivileged. How superbly it all came, as it were, at one. Her fine-fingered librettist, Mr. Harold Reith, was a man of similar affections. The ethos of pathos was everywhere apparent in the exquisite words he provided for Hilda to set. How proud he must have been feeling at this moment.
The trouble is, you can't hear a bloody word anybody sings.
How proud of the fine and sympathetic setting Hilda had accorded him. He had worked well, and not only on this first page of Act One. We were ourselves keenly looking forward to the last page, to those fine lines of his on the last page of the last act. Poor kid, poor kid. She's had a pretty thin time of it these last few weeks. But these lines, needless to say, were more than nine acts away. What a long, glorious evening we had before us.
From the left of the stage, the imperious and dominating figure of Clara Taggart, the chief buyer, has entered.
It is perhaps as well here to recall, and we ourselves can hardly avoid recalling, Hilda's own observations on the character of Clara Taggart.
The only character in the opera who may be said to be real, in the true 12-tone sense of the word, is Clara Taggart, the unhappy chief buyer who causes so much trouble to others. Now, I've studied Clara's psychology with great care. Her music may be said to represent the real me. However, I don't wish anyone to think that Clara Taggart is a musical portrait of myself. She is, in fact, based on an aunt of mine, Veronica Tablet, who died some years ago. Now, this aunt of mine was the hell of a woman. When I was a child of 11, I remember...
Come along, you're all late. This should have been finished a good 10 minutes ago. You personnel sit about here far too long, idly chattering, murmuring, gossiping, tittle, 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 tattling, making up your silly faces. Ha! Get on with it.
Did you hear, Marilyn? Hear what, dear? What Clara Taggart said? No, dear.
Come along now, hurry. Clear away those things and tidy yourselves up. Put away every bucket. Conceal every mop. It is 2 minutes to nine. We must open up the shop.
We must open up the shop.
The opera was, of course, inevitably approaching that difficult moment when Helen Sparge, the chief cashier, was to enter from the little white-tiled apartment on the left of the stage. As everyone now knew, Miss Gwyneth Morgan Davis had been forced by illness to retire from the role. We knew that Signora Deli Scoli, who had flown specially from Milan that day to take her place, was quite accustomed to the part. She had sung it at the Florentine Musical May the previous June, and with great success. We had not heard her. But Hilda had, and had spoken appreciatively and justly of her performance.
Jolly fine. Jolly fine voice. Good presence. Mind you, I don't know what ruddy opera she thinks she's singing half the time, but jolly fine all the same. Wonderful sight, too. Big girl with flaming red hair. Jolly impressive.
The stage has been empty, save for Clara Taggart, for some minutes. The music has come to a standstill, has temporarily ceased, as we wait for the appearance of Helen Sparge, chief cashier. Clara Taggart is scowling heavily.
It was, of course, a very great moment when, in Robert Browning's telling phrase, the superb abundance of Signora Delli Scoli's glittering bosom finally emerged onto the stage, followed closely by its owner. Possibly the low-cut silver and green evening gown, in which she appeared in the first act, was a little unsuited to the part of the chief cashier. But the sympathetic and intuitive audience at Covent Garden at once realized that the great diva, had left her own fair country in a great hurry and had probably had no time to change from her ordinary everyday clothes.
You, Helen Sparge, where have you been?
Sono stata alla toiletta. È una cosa normale. Ti dispiace?
Helen, there's something on my mind.
Di nuovo.
What do you mean, again?
Che cosa significa di nuovo ordinariamente?
Are you being sarcastic with your old friend?
Ho soltanto risposto alla tua domanda. Le mie parole significano solo ciò che dicono.
Oh, Helen, we used to be such friends.
Eravamo. Silly great cow.
Ma scusa, mi aspettano sopra.
Helen runs lightly off the stage, and Clara is left brooding alone once more.
Used to be.
And now the shop assistants are coming onto the stage and are taking up their places behind the various counters.
When we shall be free, will our time never come? When we shall be free, and your
faith, Marilyn, see what is. And your faith, Marilyn, see what is.
Lara Taggart. Thinking.
I knew it.
Knew what?
I sensed it. It is 3 minutes past nine. And Emily Butter is late again.
Emily Butter.
this moment in the opera. One of many such when Clara rushes into the lift and the opening and closing of the lift gates are so tellingly underlined by crashes on the harpsichord has always been one of our favourite moments in music. From our box, we could naturally see into the orchestra pit, and our eyes wandered instinctively to the fine old instrument. A judge of our horror, when we saw that apart from Miss Nuttall, the harpsichordist, and Hilda, the orchestra pit was deserted. We ourselves were among the very few members of the audience who were aware of the delicate and difficult nature of the negotiations that had been for some time in train between the Opera House and Hilda on the one hand, and the Consolidated Instrumentalists Union on the other. For the occasion of Hilda's opera, which is in 10 acts and is ideally played without an interval, the Consolidated Instrumentalists Union had, with fair reason, demanded that their fees should be cubed. No agreement had been reached half an hour before the curtain had gone up, but the disputants had throughout comported themselves with great dignity and, as always on such occasions, full appreciation of each other's point of view. We had heard Hilda express hers only a few hours before.
I don't give a damn for the Consolidated Instrumentalist so-called union. It's my music people will be coming to hear. And I think I can legitimately claim that my music is capable of standing on its own feet perfectly well without the assistance of any ruddy orchestra on God's earth. Thank you very much.
The Consolidated Instrumentalist Union itself, ever the true friend of all artistic enterprise, had been even more self-sacrificing than usual. The spokesman of the union had indeed stated that very afternoon,
"Well, we might let them play for a bit, I suppose, and see what we feel like as the thing goes on. I don't think as I can say no fairer than that. I don't think nobody could."
Everything had, therefore, seemed very promising. We knew that one or two trifling details remained to be completed, but we entertained little doubt that they would be. And now the sight of the empty orchestra chairs struck a chill to us. Although we knew that much of the opera was but lightly scored, or not scored at all, we could not recall if the present passage were such a one. We felt a little ashamed of our ignorance. There was little excuse for it, after all. During the previous 17 days, Hilda had kindly played the opera completely through to us 34 times. However, the clash of the lift doors and the harpsichord, which we had always so much delighted in, now disturbed us strangely.
Going up, going up, going up, going up, going up, going up.
The lights slowly fade on the ground floor, and the fourth floor is brilliantly illuminated. The small, pathetic figure of Emily Butter is seen standing in the doorway, talking to Mrs. Weatherall, one of the senior assistants.
"Oh, Emily, my dear child, it is 9:03. Hurry up and take off your mackintosh. I hope Miss Taggart didn't see you come in late. Have you clocked in?"
"Oh, dear Mrs. Weatherall, my kind good friend, what should I do without you? I am sorry, I am late again. It was the trolley bus from Goodes Green again. It was held up again. There was delay again. And something seemed to snap inside of me again."
"Seemed to what, dear?"
Something seemed to snap inside of me again.
I wonder what it could have been.
Going up, going up, going up, going up, going up.
Where is that new girl, Emily Butter? Was she late again?
Haste away now, it's folly to linger. Mrs. Weatherall.
Good morning, Miss Taggart. I think you wish to make arrangements.
Answer me.
To make arrangements.
Answer me.
About the question of shoplifting.
on this floor.
An internal struggle is going on inside Clara Taggart. She's trying to make up her mind about something.
Shoplifting these last few weeks, especially on this floor. There have been so many that we begin to suspect there must have been some cooperation on the part of somebody on the staff.
On the staff! Oh, how dreadful! How disloyal!
What does she say? What is she speaking of?
We think we know who it is. We feel reasonably certain it is a little woman called Mrs. Thwaite.
La Signora Thwaite?
She comes in here every morning, picking things over.
Yes, we know her.
Little Mrs. Thwaite.
But we must have proof, and proof we shall have.
Proof we shall have.
Proof we shall.
So absorbed had we become in this splendid and vigorous psychological action that only at that sudden rush of familiar and glorious sound had we realized that our earlier worry about the orchestra had been baseless. Perhaps we had only imagined its absence. Stranger things have happened. And chiding ourselves for the unworthy thought that had crossed our mind, we bent our ears afresh to the music, concentrating intently upon the entrance music for the next key figure in the complicated action of the work. Music so roguishly reminiscent in some ways at this point. Yes.
And now I want to introduce someone to you. Come in, Miss Lott.
Who can this be?
Did you hear, Madeline?
Hear what, dear?
This be
this girl's is Miss Catherine Slott, a plainclothes police lady.
Good morning, all.
What a fine, upstanding woman!
What a chest she has on her!
Good morning, all.
How tall and strong she is.
Si direbbe un uomo piuttosto che una
donna. What splendid measurements she must have.
Good morning, all.
Appreciatively round the splendid figure of Catherine Slott, the plainclothes police lady. Ah.
Miss Slott is wearing a most charming grey tweed two-piece suit with belt, sloping pockets, and a large diamante ornament on the left lapel of the jacket. Her blouse is white with foaming collar. She is, of course, as listeners will have heard, in plain clothes. The only thing possibly suggesting her profession being a neat blue helmet with silver spike, which she is wearing, tilted slightly forward upon her head.
The girls remain gazing appreciatively at the figure of Miss Slott. Emily is standing somewhat apart from the rest. Suddenly, with a low moan, she falls to the ground in a faint. The other women on the stage all turn to look at her for a moment. She remains motionless on the ground.
It's only Emily.
It's Emily again.
Emily has fainted again.
Hey, so tanto, Emilia.
Emily is always fainting.
It's always Emily.
It's only Emily.
Good morning, all.
With one accord and striking gestures of admiration, the girls turn once more to gaze at Catherine Slott. It is on this pretty tableau that the curtain slowly descends.
It has been well said that the first act of Emily Butter ends like a slowly opening flower, which remains for a brief interval suspended exquisitely in its growth. The interval was, in fact, a little longer than advertised in the programme. We were a little exercised in our minds as to possible reasons for this. But in accordance with a promise made to Hilda, we refrained from going backstage before the opera was over. But she had instructed us to collect reactions in the various foyers, though adding, of course, "I don't care a tuppenny curse what they think, of course, still, there's no harm in knowing, of course." We therefore endeavoured to collect information, much as we have always disliked eavesdropping. First, we recall, we lingered unostentatiously near a group of famous composers. We were very anxious to hear what words they might exchange about the music.
Frightfully good libretto.
Best libretto I've ever heard.
Get my ears for a libretto like that.
Particularly good libretto.
I've always said a libretto must be poetry.
And this libretto is poetry.
Frightfully good libretto.
Round the upstairs bar, we discerned a slightly smaller group of poets, whose views on Mr. Reith's fine-fingered libretto we also hoped to hear.
Jolly good music, isn't it?
Yes, awfully good music.
Frightfully good music.
The kind of music one likes.
Oh, superbly good music.
Yes, the music. So good.
The problem of wedding words and music has often been debated. But perhaps only the views of successful collaborators are worth any great account. And successful Hilda Tablet and her librettist Harold Reith had undeniably been. Listeners to the former third programme had probably already heard the absorbing discussion on the subject between Miss Tablet and Mr. Reith some days earlier. If memory does not betray us, it was, we think, again Mr. Gabriel Hall Pollock who conducted the discussion.
Good evening. Beauty?
Yes, it was Mr. Hall Pollock.
Beauty may descend like a dove upon poetry. Beauty may arise like a swan from music. But the mating of the two is a little unpredictable. Mr. Harold Reith will, I am sure, forgive me if I say that in any operatic work, it is the prime function of the librettist to act the role of accoucheur to the music. That is not the whole story, of course. There are inspired librettists and there are uninspired ones. It may be said of the best that they have always helped the composer to discover the raison d'etre of his music. And to the distinguished librettists of the past, such as Calzabigi, Metastasio, Boito himself, no mean composer, Hofmannsthal and the rest, we may now add with certainty the name of Harold Reith. I'm going to ask Miss Tablet and Mr. Reith to discuss, quite informally, the collaboration of Emily Butter. Miss Tablet, what do you consider to have been your first problem in the matter?
Well, of course, there was the difference between town and country to start with. That was a bit of a face-up. It always is.
Yes. Would you care to elaborate that point, I wonder?
Well, what I mean is, any work of art, getting it done, I mean, is bound to call for a certain amount of external stimuli. Dope, you might call them, if you were feeling unfriendly.
Oh, I'm sure no one feels that, Miss Tablet.
Good.
May I ask precisely what you mean by external stimuli?
Well, it's obvious. Reith is a townsman, and he depends a great deal on patent medicines and various messes provided by the National Health Service. I'm a country girl, so I managed to get passed on gin.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Mind you, I have to say right out that Reith has provided me with one of the finest libretti a composer could wish to set. Without the words, I couldn't possibly have done what I have done.
Mr. Reith.
I think Miss Tablet exaggerates a little there.
No, I don't.
Would you care to elaborate that point, Mr. Reith?
No, thank you.
Now, in this opera, a number of rather unusual devices are used.
Yes.
There are, for example, a number of long passages realized on film. Now, I wonder whose idea that was.
That was Mr. Reith's idea.
And I think everyone agrees that it has been a very successful idea, don't you? And everyone, I believe, hopes that Emily Butter will be the beginning of a very long musical partnership. Now, may we hope that you, Miss Tablet, and you, Mr. Reith, are planning some future work together?
No.
Clearly, such persons, and we do not question their sincerity, have forgotten the magnificent lutenist tradition in our tongue, or such later masterpieces as The Bohemian Girl and the translations of Professor Dent. Yes. We venture to suggest that people who doubt the possibilities of English as a language for opera should recall the touching dialogue in Act 6 of Emily Butter and the trio that follows it. It occurs in the scene where Emily is about to confide her troubles, not of course for the first time, to Helen Sparge, when they are interrupted by Clara Taggart. Our point is that here surely, if ever, our language comes into its own.
Something on my mind.
Dear Mello,
I don't know how to say it. Why?
Perché?
I feel a little awkward about it.
Emilia, te le prego. Se tu pensi fosse che possa tradire la tua confidenza, per esempio a Miss Taggart, ti assicuro che devi aver raccolto un'impressione completamente falsa di Helen Sparge. La tua amica sempre fedele, e tu lo sai, senz'altro.
I knew you would say that, Helen. Thank you. It puts my mind at rest.
Dear!
What are you two gossiping about over here by yourselves?
Hurry up, Mother Karen.
A look of faint doubt comes over Clara's face.
There is much too much that is furtive. There are too many whispers and lies.
Ah, yes, ha! Ah, yes, ha!
Che gentleman sonier.
And much that is left unspoken would cause a good deal of surprise.
Ah, yes, ha! Nel mondo frenebondo
is the silence for broken and over eyes.
If the silence
for silence for broken and open our eyes,
I put a name of
silence was suddenly broken.
Oh,
it would be with heartbreaking sighs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. A che gravi sospir.
And the various sounds of reproof would mount through the sorrowing sky.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Nebondo, frenebondo.
At the sudden removal of scales from our eyes.
Better so than the people of council. sing yes, let us often sing no. Oh, ah, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. Hey, Ja, hey, Ja, hey, Ja. Non dire niente, ti consiglierò. Stiamo segrete quando si può. Invece di sì, diciamo di no.
Ah, yes.
Eh già,
let us hear it in silence, if I feel it so. Let us keep our secrets in our nosy bow. As best it is, let us all see you.
Nevertheless, what does she say?
Non di meno dice.
Nevertheless, one of these days, I will have a proper showdown with the
good morning,
all. Good morning, good morning, Miss Catherine Slop.
Good morning,
all. Good morning, good morning, Miss Catherine Slop.
Very lovely, very lovely. We have, of course, anticipated somewhat in referring to this charming and touching episode from Act Six. But the human memory takes little account of chronology. And in any case, Emily Butter is one of those operas, and there are not a few of them, where during certain scenes we find ourselves ardently looking forward to the moment when we should be listening to some other scene very much further on. Yes, indeed. We remember but little of Act Two, which was realized on film, though we do, of course, recall the various thoughtful discussions we had heard between Hilda and her librettist on the subject.
But it's all on silent film, Hilda.
So what?
Silent film! What the hell am I here for?
Harold.
Yes?
Harold, dear. I sometimes find myself wondering if you know what silence means.
Hilda Tablet, you really are the most bloody impossible woman I've ever known.
I am in no way ashamed of that.
Yes. And needless to say, Act Two was closely succeeded by Act Three. We have always considered this act to contain some of the most human and some of the most profoundly psychological music, we mean psychological in the best sense, of course, since La Bohème, that neglected masterpiece, which will surely one day be revived. The action resumes at the point where Act One dropped it. The scene is especially remarkable for its penetrating insight into the character of Mrs. Thwaite, whom everyone has suspected of shoplifting.
Oh, Miss Taggart, one of the girls below, has just telephoned to say that Mrs. Thwaite is coming up in the lift.
Stations, all of you, and try and look as if you had no thought in your heads. It shouldn't be difficult with most of you.
Good morning, all.
Going up.
And now everyone has taken up a position behind this or that counter. Emily, at a sharp kick from Clara Taggart, has revived and is betraying considerable uneasiness. Miss Taggart watches her intently. The lift gates have opened and a few people have emerged. Among them is the small figure dressed in black of little Mrs. Thwett.
Illusion is the very stuff of drama, as has often been remarked. We had a stirring example of it here. Mrs. Thwaite, it will have been noticed, is always referred to as little Mrs. Thwaite, or as a small figure. Miss Gwladys Morgan Rees, who assumed this role so nobly, is not, in private life, a little woman. In fact, after the first stage rehearsal, it was found necessary to reconstruct and enlarge the lift somewhat in order to accommodate her the more completely. And even at the final dress rehearsal, some disturbance was caused by the fact that, at this point in the opera, the lift ascended to the upper part of the stage, leaving Mrs. Thwaite and the floor of the lift still waiting contentedly below. However, all this had been promptly, or fairly promptly, rectified. And our point is this, Mrs. Thwaite continued to be referred to as Little Mrs. Thwaite throughout.
The lift gates have opened and a few people have emerged. Among them is the small figure dressed in black of Little Mrs. Thwaite. She has a very large shopping bag with her. A small black veil covers the upper part of her face. She mingles discreetly with the other customers. The delicate sounds of morning shopping are now heard.
Two floors up.
Drawing on.
Can I help you, Mrs. Thwaite?
No, thank you.
I'm just looking around.
She's just looking around.
Good morning, all.
I think so. I'm just looking around.
Expensive.
Certainly. This way, madam.
I'm just looking round.
I'm just looking round to see what I see. And I will be bold, but no one sees me. I'm just looking round. I never buy much. Perhaps half a pound of wassups or such. I'm just looking round. I perhaps buy a comb, and I'm quite often found that when I get home, and I'm quite often found that when I get home, somebody, without my noticing it, has slipped into my shopping bag. Four tablets of soap, a pound of compact, two plastic egg cups, an electric iron, a pair of blankets, half a dozen pocket handkerchiefs, a small bottle of Jay's fluid, and a very long playing gramophone record. And sometimes I wonder how they can have got there when all I have been doing just looking round, just looking round, just looking round to see what I see.
She's just looking round, just looking round. Watch, wait, look, listen.
And now everyone is watching very intently as Mrs. Thwaite approaches the scarf counter and leans over ostensibly to inspect a piece of material.
If only I could warn her, prevent her, stop her in some way. Now, while I'm asking about this piece of silk, perhaps if I wiggle my tummy slightly, I may be able to make this nice little chiffon, what's its name, slip off the counter into my...
Good morning, all!
Wait, we called you, we saw you, we knew what you were up to. We slot. I charge this woman with persistent shoplifting. Stop, stop, stop! I'm about to have one of my blackouts. I'm having one of my blackouts. Everything is going round and round. It's all going round. It's all going round. I'm having a blackout. I'm having a blackout. I'm having a blackout.
She's having a blackout. A blackout.
back out.
Now the stage is suddenly plunged into darkness as Mrs. Thwaite sinks to the ground. After a moment, we see a large white tablecloth rise dimly and mysteriously from the center counter and hang hovering in the air. A bright light suddenly illuminates it. A succession of advertisements is rapidly projected upon it, and finally the words, "Body and Body present the file on Mrs. Thwaite." The next 3/4 of an hour in the opera are realized on film.
Silent film. Silent. What the hell am I there for?
Few of us have not heard, in childhood or later, those wonderful old gramophone records, discs as they are sometimes called, in which a small but mighty army of incomparable singers is heard rendering the sextet from Lucia di Lammermoor. And what singers, what echoing names, Caruso, Gallicucci, De Luca, and so on. The marvelous powers of science, pressed nobly to the service of art, have preserved such moments for us forever. But surely, in Emily Butter, we had just heard, in the flesh, something not unakin to that. Here, in the beloved old opera house, we had just heard, exquisitely blent, a cast which included such incomparable names as Miss Dillis Morgan Watkins, Miss Wentley and Morgan Thomas, Miss Gwladys Morgan Hughes, Miss Gwladys Morgan Reese, Miss Gwladys Reese Morgan, and Mrs. Alwyn Morgan Ap Reese, a cast of which English opera might well be proud indeed. It is true that Miss Gwyneth Morgan Davis was not with us, but we shall not soon forget the compliments which Signora Luciana Delli Scoli, her deputy, fresh from the home of song, Fair Italy, showered, sincerely as we believe, upon her English colleagues that night.
Che festeria! Mamma mia, si direbbe pesci vendole!
We have not forgotten that, strictly speaking, the heroine of the opera, Emily herself, was not sung by a native English artist, artiste. But, after all, our dear little friend Miss Elsa Strauss had for so long been part of our musical life that she was by now almost English by adoption, as she herself had made clear some days earlier in a recorded interview in the ever-admirable Woman's Hour.
And you must have seen a great deal of the musical life of Great Britain, Miss Strauss. Now, what would you say have been your strongest impressions?
What I have always admired most about England is a special, delicious food, which I find very beautiful and good to eat, and is made of dried pig's blood, with so very exquisite blobs of white lard in the middle, and is sewn up in the manner of sausages and black skins, and is called black pudding.
Oh, yes, delicious. I'm sure many listeners will agree with you, Miss Strauss.
Oh, yes.
But I was principally wondering about your impressions of the musical life of Great Britain, of which you must have had such a very rich experience.
Yes, but not too rich, I find. In fact, it is the only food to be found in England that I think I can truly, as you say, stomach. I do not so very much care for the rice.
The opera Emily Butter, like most of Miss Tablet's vocal works, had, of course, been conceived from the first with the idea of Miss Strauss in the principal role. It was one of those momentous collaborations between creator and interpreter which have left so many footprints on the sands of art. Nor had Miss Strauss failed to collaborate in the creative sense. As is well known, Miss Strauss has always insisted that at some point in every operatic performance she should be allowed what she charmingly terms a dance routine, usually to the gay sounds of a rousing chardas. Indeed, it is said that her non-appearance at Bayreuth in recent years dates from her unexpected insertion one night of such a moment into the part of Brunhild. We are, thank God, more tolerant in these islands. and Miss Tablet had readily inserted such a composition for Miss Strauss in the middle of the great recognition scene which concludes Act 8 of Emily Butter. But, alas, together with our memory of that enchanting moment, we are also forced to recall that our earlier trust in the loyalty of the orchestra had proved ill-founded. Promptly, at midnight, the vast orchestra had vacated the orchestra pit, declaring that unless its claims, reasonable ones as we have hinted, were satisfied, they would play no more that night. If this were the end of the story, it would be a sorry one indeed. But two most moving things happened. How could we describe them? Well, let us try. It was thus. The opening of the recognition scene, when at last Mrs. Thwaite and Emily confront each other, was perforce enacted and sung without accompaniment, save for an occasional brave note played by Hilda herself on the harpsichord.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes, it is you at last, my long-lost mother. Oh, friend, it is she at last. Mother, 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 mother. Child, you say I am your long-lost mother. Have you any marks by which you can prove it?
Say them.
Quite a number. Such as what? This little necklace, this little brooch, this little pair of earrings. What I meant was, have you any birthmarks on your person?
Swamble, swamble.
Now, as the scene proceeded, two members of the Consolidated Instrumentalists Union chanced to return to the orchestra pit to retrieve some sandwiches they had inadvertently left behind them. So struck were they by the lyrical eloquence of the scene that they seized their instruments, a double bass and a piccolo, and loyally fingered and blew the somewhat slight parts allotted to them at that point.
Have you any birthmarks on your person?
Swamble, swamble.
Such as what?
I have a little mark on my left upper arm and a dark little spot on my lip and a large ruby blaze in the middle of my back and a little grey warp on my hip.
Bravo! Bravo, Emily! Bravo! Bravo!
There are two little things between my shoulder blades, both purple and the size of half a crown. Three strawberry marks on a place I shall not name, and a raspberry one, a little lower down.
Bravo! Bravo, Emily! Bravo! Bravo!
And halfway down my leg is a little brown patch. It is crowned with a little tuft of hair. And right across my torso, there are six little moons, exactly in the shape of the great bear.
Bravo, Emily! Bravo! Bravo!
Anything else?
There is just one other thing.
What is it?
May I whisper it to you?
Certainly.
Emily is whispering.
Oh, my dear. How very uncomfortable that must make you feel sometimes.
Yes, Mother.
At this point, as we heard later, The whole orchestra, lingering close at hand, had been much struck by the beauty of the scene. And as one of them later remarked,
"You couldn't help it somehow. You felt you just had to join in. So we did."
How simply and eloquently that expresses the true musician's attitude. They felt they just had to join in. So they did.
Mind you, we got the hell of a pasting for it from the union the next day.
But a truce to these idle frivolities and vain delusions. You, Emily Butter, cannot be my child. Cannot be.
Cannot be.
Was entirely without blemish from top to from head to foot.
From top to foot. From head to foot.
But, oh, Mrs. Twain, please think carefully. Perhaps you did not notice very closely.
Nonsense. In any case, my child was a boy. Succede qualche volta, è una cosa normale.
No, no, Helen. I have never changed anything. Let alone that.
What else of that night do we recall? Many things. But one alone must suffice, and it is no light thing. There are moments in history when a whole nation seems suddenly united in a common aspiration, a common determination. Alas, that such moments should so oft depend on the stern and bloody arbitrament of war. But peace has her victories, as has been well said, and surely we must count among them the one which so electrified listeners to the BBC at 2:15 that morning.
This is the BBC third programme. We are now taking listeners back to Covent Garden for the last act of Emily Butter.
This is the BBC Home Service. We are now taking listeners back to Covent Garden for the last act of Emily Butter.
This is the BBC Light Programme. And now over to Covent Garden for the last act of Emily Butter.
Good morning. As in the earlier parts of the opera, much of Act 7, 8, and 9 of Emily Butter has been realized on film. A great, but not at all bewildering, variety of film techniques has been employed. A simple passage of silent film showing Emily's early life has been succeeded by a brief passage in Technicolor representing Emily's romantically colored memories of a childhood visit to Skegness. After this, there's been a slightly longer passage symbolizing the years of Emily's physical development. This has been filmed in 3D. And everyone in the audience has been provided with a pair of special spectacles for this sequence. And at this moment in the opera, the brilliant gathering here in the beloved old opera house tonight all cooperated splendidly by donning their spectacles at the appropriate point. Many members of the audience are indeed still wearing them. Though in the last few minutes, the passage in 3D has been succeeded by a further development. Emily is by now stretched to breaking point by her various ordeals. And appropriately enough, we have just seen her spread out round the stage as far as she will go, supine, in profile, and filmed in cinema's scope. At this point, as at several other times in her life, something seems to snap inside of her. She contracts rapidly. The lights on the stage go up, and Emily is seen, barely conscious, huddled on the cold floor of the little white-tiled apartment on the left of the lower stage. She has locked herself in. Outside the door, thronging the main part of the stage, The rest of the cast is feverishly searching for her. Clara Taggart is nowhere to be seen.
Emily Butter! Emily Butter!
She went through that door there.
Which door?
The door marked Lady's Powder Room.
She's not herself in. Emily! Emily Butter!
What is happening?
La povera ragazza dove
sta? I hope Emily's safe. She's locked in the powder room.
Oh, God!
I hope she doesn't do herself a mischief in there.
Poor kid! Poor kid! She's had a pretty thin time of it these last few weeks.
She's had a pretty thin time of it these last few weeks.
It's all that Clara Taggart's fault. It's all her doing. And I don't care who is me.
Say it! She's nothing but an old Scotch bitch.
Spotlight illuminates Emily where she still lies, crouching in exhaustion, in the little white-tiled apartment on the left of the stage.
Emily! Emily Butter!
Oh, little room, poor Emily sees you for the last time. How many times have I sat here and pitied myself, but now so strangely, so mysteriously, I pity myself no longer. I pity poor Emily no more, and all my favorite customers whom I shall never see again. I see them crowding up to the counter of my mind. And oh, tis true, tis true. But never say this is what of me again, with a little shopping pig, with a little shopping pig. With my little shopping bag full of rice and tea, full of rice, 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 and asking, will you take this bag? Oh, now will you take this bag? It got shrunk when I washed it, and I cannot.
open, little Mrs. Twain. Little Mrs. Twain, steal the pair of pretty stockings, or a pound of scented soap, or a
Rarely indeed has an opera ended on a more touching and tragic note.
So...
And it is on this note that we must, alas, bring our reminiscences of Emily Butter to a close.
So...
Not, of course, that our memories of the work are thereby exhausted, or that for ourselves they cease at that point, or even fade.
So...
Indeed, one of the supremely lovely things about memory is that it contains the whole of our past, and in it the past may live again. Memory is one of God's greatest gifts denied to the lower animals.
So,
and, of course, even the upper ones, the higher ones, have no choice in what the memory may retain.
So,
and what it may reject. Perhaps it rejects nothing. That has been suggested. And assuredly one of the wonderful things about memory is that an occasion may lie buried in it for years and years and years, for half a century it may be. Then suddenly, when one least expects, it may, quite unsought, rise up before us with astounding vividness.
So...
This is the great miracle of memory. It is at once unpredictable and inescapable. But... Never mind.
So...
Never mind.
So...
That ends Emily Butter, An Occasion Recall. Hilda Tablet's music was realized by Donald Swan, and the orchestration was realized by Max Saunders. The words were realized by Henry Reed. The production was suddenly realized by Douglas Cleverdon. This was the cast. Hilda Tablet, Mary O'Farrell. Herbert Reeve, Hugh Burden. Elsa Strauss, Marjorie Westbury. A male commentator, Michael Flanders. A female commentator, Betty Hardy. Gabriel Hall Pollock, Derek Giler. The Duke of Mulsett, Frank Duncan. The Duchess of Mulsett, Cecile Chevreau. Harold Reith, Frank Duncan. An official of the Opera House, Leonard Sachs. Poets and composers, David March, Hugh Manning, Harold Reith, and Jeffrey Siegel. The assumptions in the opera were Emily Butter, Marjorie Westbury, Clara Taggart, Anna Pollock, Helen Sparge, Marion Studholm, Elizabeth Thwaite, Rose Hill, Catherine Slott, Scott Joint, Mrs. Weatherall, Sylvia Beamish, Marilyn, Anne Dowdle, Dorothy Glennis Halliday. Symphony of London and a section of the BBC Women's Chorus were conducted by Patrick Saville. The harpsichord was played by John Wills.